With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Everyone here is mad.
Greetings. You are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Boy, do we have some weird stuff for you tonight, and some cool stuff, too. Here's some music to get us started off.
Oh, my God.
UFO strikes, a military death ray, or the coming of Armageddon. Why are thousands of birds falling from the sky? There is talk of secret government experiments with death rays, collisions with UFOs, a demagnetized Earth's core, and even the second coming. But it's not the first occasion that America has been well and truly spooked by a series of bizarre occurrences. Is there reason to be worried this time? Well, the fish died first, an estimated 85,000 carnivorous drumfish being washed up along a 17-mile stretch of the Arkansas River a couple Thursdays ago. Local experts could not recall a time when so many had died so suddenly and, because it was confined to just one species, blamed disease. On their own, dead fish, even so many, might not raise too many eyebrows, but just a day later, and only 100 miles away, was the turn of the creatures of the air to give people a fright. Just before the stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve, thousands of birds started to rain down on the small town of Beebe, Arkansas. Up to 5,000 red-winged blackbirds fell in a short stretch no more than 800 yards wide, sprinkling roads, rooftops, and lawns, and in some places, the ground was turned almost black. Terrified residents hurried indoors as the tiny creatures thudded down around them. One hit a woman walking her dog while another resident had to use an umbrella to protect herself. Local man Shane Roberts said it sounded like hail pelting on his roof. "I turn and look across my yard and there's all these lumps," he said. Milton McCullough, the town's street department supervisor, said, "It was like a scene out of an Alfred Hitchcock movie." He didn't need to spell out which film. The emergency switchboard lit up as everyone rang an alarm. Some of them were a little panicked. They thought it was the end of the world, said Eddie Cullum, the local police chief. The residents' unease only increased when the environmental cleanup workers turned up wearing white hazardous suits, helmets, gas masks to clear away the birds. Now, officials initially blamed high-altitude hail or lightning hitting the birds, then preliminary lab tests concluded they had died from multiple blunt force trauma, implying that they had flown into something. Their stomachs were empty, ruling out poison. Now, the prime suspect was New Year fireworks, which could have startled the birds from their roost and sending them crashing into houses, trees, and each other. But fireworks go off every New Year. Why hadn't this happened before? Dan Crystal, an academic and co-founder of the Institute for Integrative Bird Behavior Studies, said he found it difficult to blame fireworks unless, quote, somebody blew something into the roost, literally blowing the birds into the sky, unquote. And John Fitzpatrick, director of Cornell University's Ornithology Laboratory, suggested that the birds might have been sucked up by a washing machine-type thunderstorm, then spat back out onto the ground. Other experts still cling to the weather theory. Michio Kaku, a physics professor in New York, said that the deaths could have been caused by a flock being hit by a microburst, which is a sudden fierce downdraft of wind that have been known to bring down airliners. The U.S. Geological Survey has said that it knew of 16 cases over the past 20 years of large numbers of blackbirds dying at once. Investigators admit they may never discover what happened, but are certain the birds and fish are not connected. "We just think that it's a rather strange coincidence," said Leanne White, a wildlife disease specialist at the U.S. Geological Survey. If only the deaths had ended there, most people might have swallowed the coincidence theory. But then, something happened which sent a shiver down American spines. Last Monday, some 500 birds, mainly starlings and blackbirds, were found dead 300 miles south along a highway in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. They showed signs of internal injuries and blood clots, and the official explanation was they had probably flown into power lines. Soon after, wildlife officials in Kentucky reported several hundred birds had been found dead in the western part of the state. Then, on that Wednesday, it emerged that estimated 2 million more fish had been found dead in Chesapeake Bay on America's east coast. The local environment department blamed, quote, cold water stress, when the ocean is too cold for the fish to survive in. But that couldn't explain the thousands of dead fish found floating in a creek in Port Orange, Florida. There had been cold weather, said puzzled locals, but that had been a week before. Now, with the spotlight on deceased animals, more and more cases are just turning up, and not just in America. In Sweden, about 100 jackdaws have been found dead in the road in southern city of fell a ping. A lorry driver claimed that he ran them over, but the police said most birds had shown no signs of damage. Many Americans don't believe the official line at the best of times, and the burgeoning ranks of conspiracy theorists have found themselves spoilt for choice in picking a reason for these animal deaths. Dead birds raining out of the sky and rivers of dead fish are the stuff of apocalyptic visions, and in a country where 41% of people believe that Jesus will return by 2050, some see the hand of God and biblical end of days in all of this. Internet keyword searches in the U.S. have soared for the likes of dead fish and Bible, and dead fish and birds and Revelation. Pastors on Christian internet forums have been busy answering questions about whether what the Washington Post scathingly dubbed the Aflocalypse really does signal the beginning of the Great Tribulation mentioned in Revelation as a prelude to the final battle of Armageddon between good and evil. No, that's not a movie. That's actually a quote. Even before the wildlife started dying, an alliance of Christian groups was spreading the word that the end of the world will begin on May 21st this year. This is a date that's been calculated by the Harold Camping Group, a California preacher, based on his reading of the Bible. James Manning, a controversial pastor in Harlem, New York, has dubbed the animal deaths, quote, Global Katrina 2, unquote, in reference to the New Orleans hurricane, and blamed biological warfare. He's certain, quote, we are in a period referred to as the tribulation, unquote, and that the Bible makes clear this pre-apocalypse period will be about environmental catastrophe rather than war. All kinds of writers are turning up with all kinds of stories, and Paula Mooney, who writes for the Examiner newspaper, said this strange occurrence can't help but lead this Christian writer to remember the beginning of that 1988 movie, The Seventh Sign, wherein signs of the apocalypse, as outlined in the Book of Revelation, seem to be coming true. Okay. Those who favor the end of the world theory have also cited the ancient Mayan calendar, which runs out next year, another signpost to approaching Armageddon. Add that to the fact that bird behavior has been studied since Roman times for clues to the future. As with the canary in the coal mine, the birds are on to something earlier than the rest of us. Hollywood sci-fi films have also been plundering for support evidence that something sinister is happening. Some have flagged up the Mel Gibson film Signs, in which birds were seen flying into invisible UFOs, hovering above cities. Other theories have been anchored closer to the surface of the planet. In the Hollywood disaster movie The Core, birds start falling out of the sky because Earth's magnetic core, which they use to navigate, has shifted. Those who are wary of the U.S. government also have preferred to point the finger of blame at its High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, or HARP, which conducts research into the defense implications of harnessing the upper atmosphere's ionosphere. Some suspicious minds, reportedly including the Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, believe the project's research instruments are death rays that can excite electrons in the ionosphere and so create earthquakes, storms, and power failures. Others have wheeled out other popular conspiracy theories known as chemtrails, which claims that aircraft vapor trails are chemical agents that are being sprayed at high altitude as part of a secret government program. It might explain the birds, but the fish too? Another idea is that the New Madrid Fault Earthquake Zone, an area covering much of the U.S., Midwest, and South, including Arkansas and Louisiana, is coming to life. Those still yearning for other culprits can take their pick from pesticides or toxins released into the air by the start of major natural gas drilling operations in Arkansas, and all have their supporters on the internet. The UN Environment Program played down apocalyptic explanations, but said more research was needed into mass animal deaths. Science is struggling to explain these things, said a spokesman. There are examples of surprises that nature can still bring. More research is needed. Greg Butcher, director of bird conservation at the National Audubon Society, the U.S. equivalent of the RSPB, said he was enjoying the speculation so much he feels guilty debunking it, claiming that, in fact, fireworks are the most likely answer. But he agrees with the conspiracy theorist on one point, the importance of not ignoring birds. They can be good indicators of environmental problems in telling us something is wrong. So I'd hate to think that 5,000 would die and nobody would care, he said. Just now, with the internet humming and preachers announcing an imminent Armageddon, there doesn't seem to be any danger of that. Now, if you'd like to take a look at some of the scientific ideas that are being put out in specifics, you can look for Michio Kaku's blog on Big Think, or you can go to the UN Environment Program, or you can go to the U.S. Geological Survey and basically just Google the same thing all those other people are Googling and sit back and read it and see what you think. Time will tell. And yes, large die-offs happen all the time, but at this magnitude in one concentrated area, we really need to take a look at the environment and see what's going on. So keep you posted on that. And speaking of environment, there's snow on the ground in 49 of the 50 states in the U.S. After the big snow and ice events in the southeast, plains, and midwest this week, 49 out of the 50 states currently have snow on the ground. Yes, even Hawaii, where snow falls in Mauna Loa and Mauna Kea all winter. Now, the only state that has avoided this icy blast is Florida. Does that not make you want to go on a nice warm vacation to the Sunshine State? You're not alone. Put another way, that means that snow is present in 69.4% of the lower 48, which is more than double than December. This is extremely unusual, though it's hard to put a date on when this last happened because records aren't kept on this kind of event. The National Operational Hydraulic Remote Sensing Center combines ground reports and images from satellites in space to determine how much of the country is covered in snow. And that's what you would see if you Google that image. Now, the images tell how deep and widespread the snow is, and that's not important not only for the images like that one, but also for computer weather models, which use the data to generate accurate forecasts. Such forecasts are very useful in predicting storms like this week's storms. Earlier in the week, two storms began to churn, one in the northern plains and Midwest and one in Texas. The southern winter storm took a track across the Gulf Coast, pulling warm, moist air over an extreme Arctic blast that set up over the eastern half of the U.S. late last week. This provided fuel for the storm to carve a path of snow, sleet, and freezing rain from Texas to the Carolinas. In Atlanta, they're still coated in snow and ice and probably will be for the next couple days. Now, no one in the southeast escaped the wrath, of course, Florida. But it's not over. Now that the southern track storm has moved into the Atlantic and is moving north, the other Midwest storm is going to merge with it, creating a northeastern event that could dump up to 2 feet of snow in the northeast. Winter storm warnings and advisories have been posted for the event. 32 states have winter warm advisories issued, by the way. And you can look up those storm forecasts on your local and national weather stations. And who knows, this may be contributing to all those deaths of all those birds. I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there. Hey, everybody else has got a theory. Why not me too, right? Hypothesis, excuse me. Here's a little music break.
They just might not fit the same. 'Cause nothing's worth losing, especially the chance to make it right. And I know that we're gonna be fine. And the tattooed mistakes are gonna fade over time. As long as we and we won't get it back when we
astronomers are shedding the light on the dark ages of the universe. They have discovered the quote-unquote missing link in the evolution of the universe following the Big Bang, it has been claimed. Let's check this out. For years, scientists have known nothing about the dark ages of space, a period between the Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago and the creation of the first stars. But Cambridge University researchers have now captured light emitted from a massive black hole to peer into this unknown portion of the history of the universe. They discovered remnants of the first stars and evidence of the aftermath of an exploding star which was 25 times bigger than the sun. Professor Max Pittini of Cambridge's Institute of Astronomy believes the discovery of these gases could help reveal the origins of the universe. He said, "We have effectively been able to peer into the dark ages using the light emitted from a quasar. The light provides a backdrop against which any gas cloud in its path can be measured. We discovered tiny amounts of elements present in the cloud in proportions that are very different from their relative proportions in normal stars today. Most significantly, the ratio of carbon to iron is 35 times greater than measured in the sun. The composition enables us to infer that the gas was released by a star 25 times more massive than the sun and originally consisting of only hydrogen and helium. In effect, this is a fossil record that provides us with a missing link back to the early universe." Cambridge's Institute of Astronomy teamed up with researchers of California Institute of Technology to carry out the groundbreaking research. They used light emitted from a massive black hole called a quasar to light up gases released by the young stars. These early stars are believed to hold the key to how the universe evolved from being filled with hydrogen and helium to one rich in heavier elements such as oxygen, carbon, and iron. Lasting half a billion years after the Big Bang, this period is inaccessible to telescopes because the clouds of gas that filled the universe then were not transparent. But astronomers in California and Cambridge successfully located a rare cloud released from a star using the world's largest telescopes in Hawaii and Chile. The results provide experimental observations of a time that has so far been possible to model only with computer simulations. And speaking of today's weather, thunder and antimatter beams. Positrons appear to be common in terrestrial lightning storms. Forget about gamma rays from the hearts of distant galaxies. Scientists now believe gamma rays, as well as beams of energetic particles of antimatter, are common components of lightning storms right here on Earth. In 2009, researchers announced that NASA's Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope had, for the first time, detected gamma rays produced by antimatter generated in terrestrial lightning storms. Now, after analyzing additional gamma ray signals produced by terrestrial positrons, the antimatter counterpart to electrons, Michael S. Briggs of the University of Alabama in Huntsville and his colleagues think that the antimatter beams do not require special conditions to be generated. Briggs presented the latest findings during a news briefing January 10th at the winter meeting of the American Astronomical Society. Details will appear in an upcoming geophysical research letters, and you can look that up or keep that on your alert. The idea that any planet has thunderstorms that not only produce antimatter but then launch it into space seems like something straight out of science fiction, commented Stephen Coomer of Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. He was not part of the study, however, but he did have a lot to say about it. That our own planet does this has probably done it for hundreds of years, and that we've only just learned it is amazing to me, he said. According to Briggs, positrons and electrons form in terrestrial gamma ray flashes, short bursts of gamma rays produced inside thunderstorms. This was first observed in the 1990s, of course, that we just talked about. Gamma ray flashes are still not well understood, though. Now, when the positrons meet up with electrons, they annihilate each other, producing gamma rays of specific energy, 511,000 electron volts. The Fermi Observatory has usually been located directly above thunderstorms when it has detected positron-generated gamma rays, but in four cases, the lightning storms were thousands of kilometers away from the region on Earth that the telescope was observing. In one striking event on December 14th, 2009, Fermi was orbiting over Egypt when the only active storm was in Zambia, some 4,500 kilometers to the south. Because the storm was not in Fermi's line of sight, the craft could not have detected gamma rays that came directly from the terrestrial disturbance. Yet, Fermi did record gamma rays characteristic of annihilation between electrons and positrons that lasted for 30 milliseconds, the longest it has ever recorded such terrestrial signals. Briggs' team suggests that electrons and positrons produced in the Zambia storm surfed along Earth's magnetic field to strike the Fermi craft. Many of the electrons and positrons annihilated each other immediately, producing the telltale gamma rays, but some of the particles continued on past Fermi and were magnetically reflected back toward the craft 23 milliseconds later, only then pairing off to produce the gamma rays. The newly discovered antimatter beams, quote, gives us some very important information that we can use to piece together what is going on when lightning initiates and propagates, Kummer said. Very cool. So, you want to check that out, what's coming up in that paper? Look for geophysical research letters that should be coming out pretty soon. And speaking of space and what's going on up there, astronomers confirmed the first rocky planet outside the solar system. A newly discovered planet beyond the solar system is not only the smallest extrasolar planet yet found, also it was the first confirmed to be made entirely of solid material. Discovered by NASA's Kepler spacecraft and dubbed Kepler-10b, the body has a diameter only 40% larger than Earth's. Likely to be partially molten, the planet is too hot to contain liquid water or support life as known on Earth. But the planet's mass and diameter are known to such high accuracy that the object, quote, is the first unquestionably rocky planet that humanity has ever seen, unquote, said Kepler team manager Natalie Batalla of San Jose University in California. She described the findings January 10th at the winter meeting of American Astronomical Society. Oh boy, it was busy there. Scientists are especially interested in finding rocky planets because chemical reactions that form the building blocks of life may happen most readily on solid surfaces. Now, the more rocky planets we can find, the better placed we will be to understand the subset that are in the habitable zone, said theorist Rory Barnes of the University of Washington in Seattle. Astronomer Adam Burrows of Princeton University concurred, saying that the discovery bodes well for Kepler finding other such rocky objects with high precision. The finding, said Kepler researcher Jeff Marcy of the University of California, Berkeley, boy, a lot of scientists in this article, ranks, quote, among the most profound scientific discoveries in human history, unquote. Kepler-10b, he added, will go into every textbook worldwide. Now, in early February, the Kepler team is expected to announce a trove of newly discovered exoplanets, including several super-Earths. So stay tuned. There's a lot of planet traffic going on out there. And we'll bring it all to you. You can check it out on NASA also.
I was walking down the street when out the corner of my eye I saw a pretty little thing approaching me. She said, I've never seen a man who looks so all alone, or could you use a little company? But if you pay the right price, your evening will be nice and you can go and send me on my way. Yourself. She looked at me and this is what she said, oh, there ain't no rest for the wicked, money don't grow on trees, I got bills to pay, I got mouths to feed, there ain't nothing in this world for free, I know I can't slow down, I can't hold back, though you know I wish I could, I know there ain't no rest for the wicked, until we close our eyes for good. Not even 15 minutes later, I'm still walking down the street when I saw the shadow of a
Chemistry, Hong Kong researchers store data in bacteria. The U.S. National Archives occupy more than 500 miles, which is 800 kilometers, of shelving. France's archives stretch for more than 100 miles of shelves, as do Britain's. Yet, a group of students at Hong Kong's Chinese University are making strides towards storing such vast amounts of information in an unexpected home, the E. coli bacterium, better known as a potential source of serious food poisoning. This means you will be able to keep large data sets for the long term in a box of bacteria in the refrigerator, says Aldrin Yim, a student instructor on the university's biostorage project, a 2010 gold medalist in the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT's, prestigious iGEM competition. Biostorage, the art of storing and encrypting information in living organisms, is a young field, having existed for about a decade. In 2007, a team at Japan's Keio University said that they had successfully encoded the equation that represents Einstein's theory of relativity, E equals mc squared, in the DNA of a common soil bacterium. They pointed out that because bacteria consistently reproduce, a group of the single-celled organisms could store a piece of information for thousands of years. But the Hong Kong researchers have leapt beyond this early step, developing methods to store more complex data and starting to overcome practical problems which have lent weight to skeptics who see the method as science fiction. The group has developed a method of compressing data, splitting it into chunks and distributing it between different bacterial cells, which helps to overcome limits on storage capacity. They are also able to map the DNA so information can be easily located. This opens up the way to storing not only text, but images, music, and even video within cells. As a storage method, it is extremely compact because each cell is minuscule. The group says that 1 gram of bacteria could store the same amount of information as 452,000 gigabyte hard disks. They have also developed a 3-tier security fence to encode the data, which may come as welcome news to U.S. diplomats who have seen their thoughts splashed over the internet thanks to WikiLeaks. Bacteria can't be hacked, points out Alan Yu, another student instructor. All kinds of computers are vulnerable to electrical failures or data theft, but bacteria are immune from cyber attacks. You can safeguard the information. The team have even coined a word for this field, biocryptography, and the encoding mechanism contains built-in checks to ensure that mutations in some bacterial cells do not corrupt the data as a whole. Professor Chanting Fung, who supervised the student team, told AFP that practical work in the field fostered by MIT, who have developed standards enabling researchers to collaborate, was in its early stages. He said what the students did was try it out and make sure some of the fundamental principles are actually achievable. The Hong Kong group's work may have a more immediate application. The techniques they use, removing the DNA from bacterial cells, manipulating them using enzymes, and returning them to a new cell, are similar to those used to create genetically modified foods. But rather than changing the building blocks of an organism, the Hong Kong group allows extra information to piggyback on the DNA of the cell after checking their changes against a master database to make sure they do not have accidental toxic effects. Their work could enable extra information to be added to a genetically modified crop in the form of a biobarcode, Chan said. For example, a company that makes a GM tomato that grows extra large with a gene that promotes growth, on top of that, we can actually encode additional information like safety protocols, things that are not directly related to the biological system. Other types of information, like copyright and design history, could help to monitor the spread of GM crops, he said. It's kind of a safety net for synthetic organisms, said Wong Kit Ying from the student team also. Now, beyond this, Chan and the students are evangelical about the future possibilities of synthetic biology. The field is getting popular because they are thinking of the energy crisis, environmental pollution, climate change, just to name a few. Now, they are also thinking about a biological system that will be a future solution to those as an alternative energy source, also a remedy for pollution. Now, for these, microorganisms are the obvious choice. One type of bacterium, D. radiodurans, can even survive nuclear radiation. Bacteria are everywhere, so they can survive things that are unthinkable to humans, and we can make use of this. So, is it possible that a home computer could one day consist of a dish filled with microorganisms? The group dismisses concerns that this could be dangerous, pointing out that despite E. coli's poor reputation, they use an altered form that cannot exist outside a rich synthetic medium. In fact, says Chin, while safety rules are strict, more measures are taken to protect the bacteria from contamination than protect the researchers from the bacteria. However, Yim admitted that while the group's work is a, quote, foundational advance, unquote, a Petri dish PC is not likely to be on the market in the coming years, at least because the method of retrieving the data requires experts in a laboratory. It's possible, he said, but there's a long way to go. And as we started to talk about a couple weeks ago, Garrett Lisi, he's a surfer dude and PhD in physics. Garrett Lisi explains the E8 Lie geometry and his theory of everything from the Science Channels through the Wormhole with Morgan Freeman. Here's a little bit more about Garrett Lisi and his ideas of how the universe works.
Scientists have spent decades and billions of dollars on this quest. They've built giant atom-smashing machines to probe how the four fundamental forces actually work. They've found that down at the microscopic level, billions of times smaller than atoms, forces are actually caused by the movement of tiny particles. Electromagnetism is carried by photons. The strong force is carried by particles called gluons. The weak force by particles called the W and Z bosons. But they've never found the force carriers for gravity. The elusive gravitons. And that's where their efforts to unify the math of the universe are stuck. Treading water. But renegade physicist and compulsive surfer Garrett Lisi could be on the cusp of succeeding.
Right after people got the idea that there were these electromagnetic weak and strong forces, which were towards the end of the 70s, almost immediately people saw how they fit together to make a grand unified theory unifying those three forces. Now, it's much trickier to try to bring gravity into the picture because it's slightly different.
Tricky is an understatement. The greatest minds in physics have all but given up on unifying gravity and its unseen gravitons with the other three forces. But then, Garrett has a vision. A vision of twisted circles.
I was working on just how this whole algebraic structure fit together of gravity and the other forces. And I started to wonder if this thing could be understood as a whole. If this entire structure could be described as part of some larger Lie group. A Lie group is a mathematical shape that is a collection of circles twisting around each other in a specific pattern. Now, the simplest Lie group is just a circle. Now, if you take a second circle and you wrap it around that inner circle, keeping it perpendicular, you get what's called a torus. It looks like the surface of a donut. But if you take a third circle and keep that perpendicular to the other two, and you twist it around the inner circle as you wrap it around, you can get all three of those circles to twist around each other to form a three-dimensional shape.
But this is only the beginning. Garrett kept on twisting circles around one another until he'd done it 248 times. The end result is a shape so complex that it can't even be fully appreciated in three dimensions. It's called the E8 Lie group. To us, it's just a mind-bending pattern. But Garrett Lisa realized the way the circles twisted around one another looked just like the way various fundamental particles interact.
In physics, each one of these circles can be associated with a different kind of elementary particle. One circle could correspond to electrons, the other circles could correspond to the force particles, such as photons, or weak force particles, or strong force particles, the gluons.
For months, Garrett turned this kaleidoscope over and over in his mind, and then it hit him. He found a set of circles that seemed to act like the never-yet-seen graviton, and for the first time in the history of physics, a mere mortal saw how gravity might fit in with all the other forces and particles.
You know, seeing how gravity could be combined with these other Lie groups during this unification was one of the greatest moments of my life.
Garrett calls this dizzying geometrical relationship between all the particles and forces in the universe an exceptionally simple theory of everything. It predicts several as yet undiscovered particles, and scientists across the world are on the hunt for those right now. One is the most sought-after particle in all of physics, the Higgs boson.
There are some parts that are in this larger group that are not clearly these elementary particle forces, but what they are is exactly what you need to describe the Higgs field. And the Higgs field is this geometric particle field that gives masses to all known elementary particles. And it's exactly the missing puzzle piece you need to tie everything together.
The center of the action in the Higgs hunt is halfway around the world from Garrett's beaches. In the cooler but no less scenic city of Geneva, Switzerland, researchers are peering through the most advanced scientific microscope in human history, the LHC, or Large Hadron Collider. They're throwing everything they have at finding the Higgs boson, the particle that is supposed to give everything mass. But they should also be able to detect some of those new particles predicted by Garrett Lisi. If they do exist, the exceptionally simple theory of everything could finally offer a blueprint of the entire universe.
Wow, are you as intrigued by that as I am? Well, you can go on TED Talks and you can look up Garrett Lisi, GarrettLisi, A Beautiful New Theory of Everything, and listen to his 22-minute presentation, or you can go to his website, GarrettLisi.com. And there's all kinds of clickable links on there, and you can start reading it for yourself. And what do the scientists think? Well, let's face it, this is going to be up for discussion. We have M-theory, string theory, and we have the theory of everything. And this is going to be batted around by physicists and other scientists for many, many years to come. I think we're doing pretty darn well as a human species and our intellectual capabilities, considering we only just started wearing clothing about 170,000 years ago. Yep, that's true. It's what the University of Florida researchers have deduced from an unlikely source, the annoying clothing louse. David Reed, associate curator of mammals at the Florida Museum of Natural History on the University of Florida campus, worked with colleagues worldwide for 5 years to sequence the DNA of clothing lice to determine when they first began to diverge from the harmless but cringe-inducing head louse. Now, this study, in this month's print edition of Molecular Biology and Evolution, finds that one louse species began to diverge into two about 170,000 years ago, 70,000 years before humans started migrating to colder climates, which began about 100,000 years ago. Because clothing doesn't last for 170,000 years, looking at lice was the best way to deduce this. Interestingly, humans seem to have started wearing clothes well after they lost body hair, which genetic skin coloration research puts at about 1 million years ago. That means that people spent a good long while wandering around without protective and warming body hair and without clothing, says Reed. It wasn't until they had clothing that modern humans were then moving out of Africa into other parts of the world, Reed said. Of course, the Aborigines in Australia will disagree with that, but let's just not go there. A previous study of clothing lice in 2003 by geneticists at the Max Planck Institute in Leipzig, Germany, estimated humans began wearing clothing about 107,000 years ago. Switch the 7 and the 0 there. But the Florida researchers think that their data and calculation methods are much more precise. This means modern humans probably started wearing clothes on a regular basis to keep warm when they were first exposed to ice age conditions. Ian Gilligan, lecturer at the School of Archaeology and Anthropology at the Australian National University, said in a release. While the Ice Age occurred about 120,000 years ago, from the study results, humans probably began wearing clothing the one before it 180,000 years ago. Modern humans first appeared about 200,000 years ago. So if you want to know about this, take a look at that journal that I just mentioned, Molecular Biology and Evolution, and see what you think. Well, that about does it for this edition of Savage Science Radio. Thank you for joining us, and have a wonderful week. Keep your powder in your pants dry, and happy trails to you until we meet again. Thank you.
but in the long run